Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Thursday morning. It's almost April, Matt.
It is, man. I think winter is behind us. I don't know if spring is always here. Some days it feels like it is. Some days it feels like it ain't. But I do think winter, the snow thing, is probably not looming, at least where I am, in southern DMZ.
Now, I know you are living farther away from your beloved Orioles, but are you still... Do you still have some childish excitement over opening day?
Yes, I do. I would call it winsome or childlike. Maybe not childish. I think it's a healthy thing. We're born again. There's new grass on the field, as John Fogerty might say. It's a big day, man. It's a marker of leading us into something new, which brings me, I should say, I've got these conflicted emotions, but I'll start with the something new, with the green grass view, which is, Bill, as you know, I have a new book coming out.
It's very exciting, Matt.
Thank you. Filthy Rich Politicians. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask the DMZ Army to pre-order. This will be a big, big help. As you know, Bill, there's nothing you could, if you like an author, there's nothing you could do for them better than to pre-order their book. It's called Filthy Rich Politicians, and available now for pre-order wherever fine books are sold.
Okay, Matt, if you're going to sell a book, you got to have an elevator pitch, you know. Give me the sell in two sentences.
It's how the rich get elected and how the elected get rich.
Now, are you
if you have the "and" you know, in there.
Are you an equal opportunity offender in this book?
Yes, I am, Bill. yes, I am. We'll go after is the wrong word. We expose filthy rich politicians on the left and the right. I mean, really, this is an area where I'm a populist because I think there is a sense out there that the elites, the ruling class, our elected officials who are supposed to be our public servants, that the game is rigged for them. And that sense, I think, is undermining trust in democracy and trust certainly in our elites and our elected officials. So I think this is an issue where I'm kind of a populist because I'm also an institutionalist. I want to protect the institution. This is a bipartisan problem. You know, things like insider trading or alleged insider trading, that is not a respecter of persons, Bill. There are people like Nancy Pelosi who've made very lucky, well-timed trades, and also people like Richard Burr. Is it Richard Burr? No, that's an actor.
People. No, that's right. That's right.
There are politicians on the right, including, I think, as I recall, even Marjorie Taylor Greene, after talking about people who were profiteering off of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it turned out that she, now probably someone who was handling her investments, but that they had bought stock in you know, the war machine, essentially as the tanks were rolling across the border there. So yes, this is not something just that goes after just Republicans or Democrats.
So give us a peek behind the curtain. Tell us the glamour that is book rollout. I mean, what do you have a team of people that is helping you get the word out? Is the publisher doing stuff for you, or do you have to carry this all on your own? What's happening?
And by the way, I think I was thinking of Richard Burton for some reason, right, but basically, yes, we have my publisher is Hachette, and it's their conservative imprint called Center Street. And we have the publisher's helping. I have a publicist, but I mean, the truth is in the publishing world today, you kind of have to do it on your own, and whatever you get from the publisher, I think you consider icing on the cake. So I can just tell you from my own personal experience with my last book, Too Dumb to Fail. I think Tucker Carlson had me on like Fox and Friends in the morning. I went on, the book rolled out on Morning Joe, and I think pretty much all the publicity that book got came from me with the exception of something I could not have gotten on my own, which was a front page of New York Times book review, which I shared with EJ Dion. And so it's like, work as if it all depends on you, pray as if it all depends on God. Same thing. Like the publisher, they may deliver big things with my publicist, but I have to, in my mind, I got to be hustling because, I mean, Bill, it's hard to sell books. I think Ron DeSantis sold 150 books, his last book, not 150,000, mm-hmm. 150 books.
This is when you're the congressman. We've seen
stories where people like Meghan McCain and Governor Cuomo sell like very small, like hundreds of books, not thousands. It ain't easy to do it. And that's why I call upon the DMZ Army to pre-order. And Bill, pre-ordering is important for a couple reasons. Number one, the bestseller list, in the best time to make a bestseller list is the first week your book is out. But pre-orders count. It's sort of like banking votes, you know, early voting, banking them before election.
You're violating your principles about voting, but voting should be on election day. We should not have 30 days of voting. That is warping the system, man.
Fair point, but we do have 30 days of pre-ordering, more than that, because my book's not out for a couple of months. But that's essentially the thing, right? And so, first of all, getting on the bestseller list, everybody wants it, it's prestigious, but it also sells books, right? If you get on the bestseller list, that in and of itself will spark more people, spur more people to buy the book, to be interested in it. And that's really the goal. If you write something, you want people to read it. The other thing about pre-orders is it will tell if my publisher sees that we're already moving books, they will put more resources into promoting the book. And if Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and everyone sees that we are already selling books, they will put more emphasis on having it in their store and displaying it prominently on the shelf. So that is why it is so important. Do not wait. I beg of you. I beg of you. If you like what we do here, in fact, if you need to pull out money from Bill's Patreon and sort of reapply it to supporting us, we will be okay with that. Do what you have to do. So thank you for indulging me. That's the good news, Bill. That's what happened to me this week. We just announced the launch. And Bill, by the way, thank you. Bill's going to be doing some help. You've already helped a lot with editing and researching and giving me ideas for the book. Greatly appreciate that. And you're going to be interviewing me soon.
Yes.
About it.
Yes.
But something bad happened too, Bill. I was, my wife and I were hiking in Clark County, Virginia this weekend, and our car was broken into. Someone broke the window, smashed out the hatchback window. That's one of those little side windows on the hatchback, and stole her purse and got her license and her credit card, which is not good, but she immediately canceled all of her cards online. Police came. They were incredibly quick, professional, polite, filled out a police report. And, you know, even today they're supposed to come and they're actually coming to our house and they're going to fix the window. The insurance is covering it. So we felt like, you know, they maybe got $40 or $50 worth of cash. No big deal. We canceled the credit cards. We filed a police report, you know, it's not that big of a deal. And then this morning I wake up and my wife is like on the phone with Wells Fargo. Somebody went into a Wells Fargo bank yesterday with her canceled card, business card and her license, and took out, I forget, it's like $3,000 or $4,000 worth of cash. And so now she's got all of these checks that are about probably to bounce and payments to people. So that's not good.
Yeah.
This is the state I'm in, Bill. I'm just laying my cards on the table. I'm on my fifth cup of coffee today. I'm energetic and happy about launching my book, and I'm also in this emotional turmoil.
Yeah.
And it's the feeling of being violated, and now of like incompetence, right? Because everything was okay, and our bank allowed someone who isn't my wife to walk in.
Yeah.
and without entering a PIN number, withdrawing from a credit card that has been canceled.
So that's weird.
Talk me down, Bill. Talk me down.
I got nothing for you there. I mean, has the bank apologized to you?
I don't think apologizing is
a restitution. Do they acknowledge the mistake and we'll get you your money back?
Yeah, but the problem is that it's going to take 2 to 3 business days. I mean, this is as of now. We are launching a campaign. She is, you know, on the phone trying to get. But the problem is, it's going to take several business days, in which time she will probably bounce multiple checks from her business. So this is the frustration that we are facing.
This is her business account, not your personal bank.
It's her business account, yeah. So, all right. Good show, Bill. I'm going to go drink some gin and forget all about this. You know what would make me feel better? Mm-hmm. If you feel bad about what happened to me, you go today, you pre-order right now. Just hit pause. Pre-order Filthy Rich Politicians, and I think I will get over this if you do that.
So if a conservative is a liberal who's been mugged, what happens when a conservative gets mugged? What do you become a fascist?
I think I was tough on Law and Order before this happened, and now I'm going to be radical about it. It's going to be, I'm even more hardcore.
But this was you were in Virginia, not West Virginia.
No, right. So right across the border, I live incredibly close to Clark County, Virginia, Loudoun County, Virginia, Frederick County, Washington County, Maryland. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of right, a whole bunch of states all around me. I could be in Pennsylvania in a half hour, probably. So yeah, it was in Virginia, at a state park. My son had to do something with some classmates from school. So we dropped him off and then we went to this park, which is about 15 minutes away. And we just did like a mile or two mile hike with our other son and came back. And as my younger son's about to get in the car, he's like, "Dad, there's glass all over." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "What?" And someone, I don't know what they used. My guess is that they were sitting in the parking lot. This is a parking lot full of people, by the way, full of cars, not always full of people, but we made the mistake of kind of parking at the back close to the entrance instead of closer to the trailhead or in the middle where more cars were. But someone, I'm guessing they sat there and watched us arrive, watched my wife put her purse in the trunk under some coats or something to make, you know, and then as soon as we were on the trail, they probably somehow bashed in. The police officer said it would not have been easy to break that glass. I don't know what they used to do it. But the one thing that brings me a little solace is that I suspect now that someone has physically gone into a bank and made a deposit, there now may be some sort of chance that they find this person.
The security footage.
Because now it's multiple thousands of dollars and there was no cameras at this park, but there probably are cameras at a bank, I would
have. Right.
You would hope. Maybe that's the one silver lining maybe here.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
I hope that gets favorably resolved. So you might not have been paying too close attention to politics over the past few days, considering everything you've been going through.
Yeah, I've been on Shameless book self-promotion, you know, launch this week. But tell me, Bill, what's going on?
You know, I've been, you know, busy myself. I don't know how much you want to get into the story, but I have a big story up at the Washington Monthly right now about immigration. And I did learn a lot in this piece. This is a subject area where I wasn't, you know, too deep in beforehand. But I learned about a program that the Biden administration started a couple months ago. It's called Welcome Corps, where you can assemble, you know, a group of 5 people and say, I'm willing to sponsor a refugee and expand the ranks of people willing to take in refugees. And so the question then became, well, how that's interesting. How how potentially impactful could this be? How much could you scale this up to deal with, you know, the pressure that's currently on the southern border? And that's a more complicated question. And so what I learned in this process is, I mean, there's various pathways to coming in the country. And your Welcome Corps is not the primary way that Biden is trying to manage the flow on the border. The bigger thing that he has been doing in the short run is he's trying to make it harder to go to the border and ask for asylum. And so, and we talk about illegal border crossers, but it is you have a legal right to ask for asylum. You're not breaking the law if you cross the border and say, hey, I need asylum.
Mm-hmm.
You may not get asylum. You may have your case adjudicated and the judge will say, you actually don't qualify.
Right.
But you're not breaking the law by asking.
Because coming from like a poor, dangerous country doesn't meet the threshold of what you would need to claim it, right? You need to be some sort of political persecution.
It's not just political. If you're part of a group that's being targeted in some way, that can qualify, and that has been expanded in many places, and I believe as well as the UN's refugee agency is concerned. If you're a victim of domestic violence, you know, you're being targeted for your gender. If gang violence is targeting your family or a group of people in your neighborhood, that qualifies. Trump had narrowed that where those things didn't qualify. Biden's opened that back up again. So that does cover potentially a lot of the people that we've had this huge spike from people coming from Cuba, from Venezuela, from Haiti, from Nicaragua. These are countries that have not historically been huge sources of asylum seekers. You look at the data, you know, before the pandemic, those four countries, you're talking, you know, thousands at best, you know, single digit thousands. And in 2022, it's not just those four countries, but countries beyond Mexico and the so-called Northern Triangle. So Northern Triangle is Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, plus Mexico. Like those four have been the lion's share of southern border migration pre-pandemic. In 2022, people from outside those four countries is nearly a million people. I mean, just going from like tens of thousands to almost a million people in that year. So that's why there's all this talk about a border influx.
And by the way, Bill, this may be beyond the scope of what you wrote about, but I heard somewhere that the border crossings being up is misleading because essentially they keep deporting people who are crossing multiple times.
Well, so
that number is
Trump brings in this so-called Title 42, which is we're in a pandemic, it's a public health emergency. You come across the border saying you need asylum. I don't care. Go back. Even though there is a law that says if you ask for asylum, you get to go through the asylum process, Title 42 supersedes that. Go back home.
Is this remain in Mexico?
I think that is.
Or is that different?
There may be some interplay. Because I think remain in Mexico says you need to ask for asylum while you're in Mexico. Forgive me if I'm wrong about that. That's my understanding. Title 42 is just, I caught you. I'm sending you back. That's it. If you want to go apply for asylum, you do it in Mexico. Don't cross the border. When you are sent back in Title 42, that doesn't stop people from trying again. So that's why you are seeing more multiple attempts from the same people in recent years than we had been previously. So when you look at, you know, some of the data is, you know, number of encounters that could incorporate people doing it multiple times. Now, Biden has kept Title 42 around, although he's trying to get rid of it, and apparently it's going to go away in May. And so that has created concerns. You're going to get this huge influx of people after that. So Biden has tried to implement some policies to mitigate that. And so the main thing that he...
Before we move on, but why would he want to get rid of it? It seems like maybe it is working. Why would he? Like, he's already got problems at the border. Why would he want to change that?
Well, you know, one is legal. I mean, if, you know, Congress just voted to end the COVID emergency. There's no COVID emergency. How do you have Title 42?
Okay, but then how does he do student loan, whatever? Wasn't that premised off of... And by the way, we're still using some 2003 resolutions to, like, for our military, aren't we? I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, there's multiple pressures here. So one is the question, can you legally keep it going at this stage of the pandemic? The other is you have political pressure from within your base. This was Trump's awful, punitive program that is in violation of asylum law. You said you're going to fix this and you're not fixing it. Of course, at the same time, you have various cities saying there are too many people still coming in and we can't handle that influx. I mean, so it's one thing to say we as a nation can not only handle immigration, it's good for America. It's good that we are growing. It's good that people are coming to do jobs other Americans aren't doing. It's good that we're expanding our tax bases. It's good for economic growth. That can be true in the long run. I should also add that we have a workforce shortage right now. We have very low unemployment. We have employers having a hard time finding people to do jobs. So here, you really want people to alleviate the job market pressures. At the same time, you have a short run problem. You know, 1,000 people show up on a city's doorstep. They need a bed. They don't actually have a job right away. You know, so the process of getting them settled is complicated, and cities aren't equipped to handle that, you know, in a short period of time. So there's a chaotic element to the asylum path because people just show up. There's no sponsor here waiting for them. There's no job in hand for them. There's already an enormous, there's only about 600 immigration judges to adjudicate asylum claims. There's a backlog of well over a million asylum seekers. And so the average wait time for a case to be adjudicated is about four years. And the way the current law works, you come in, you say you have asylum. Okay, you can stay and wait until your case is heard, which is a very long time. And on one hand, you can say, well, fine, let them come here and figure out and find a job. We need the people. But there's also exploitation that occurs. There's a New York Times expose a few weeks ago. A lot of unaccompanied minors are crossing the border asking for asylum. And they get here and they're getting shunted into factory work, even though they're, you know, 12, 13 years old. So there's a lot of problems, you know, with the asylum path. And so Biden is trying to make this more orderly, although in doing so, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to accommodate the most people. So there's tensions there. So what Biden is saying is, I'm going to make it harder for you to ask for asylum. You're going to have to initially petition for asylum before you cross the border, which are people on the left and the ACLU saying that's in violation of asylum law. If you do that, we're going to sue you. So Biden has proposed that rule, hasn't been formally approved yet and implemented, but when he does that, it's probably going to get a lawsuit. He's also saying, okay, so instead of just asking for asylum, I'm going to expand this classification called humanitarian parole. This is, I mean, we're going to parole you from the normal immigration laws if you come from certain countries. So they did this for Ukraine last year. That program is called United for Ukraine. We've brought in over 100,000 Ukrainian refugees through that. Now BIOTIX has expanded it to Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela, just those countries. And
Ron DeSantis is saying, come on into Florida.
Right. So
we won't send you to Martha's Vineyard as long as you vote Republican.
So up to 30,000 people from those four countries can come in via humanitarian parole, but you need a sponsor for that program. You need someone in America has to file an application saying, I'm going to sponsor this particular person. I'm pledging to give this person financial support when they get here. So last month we brought in about 22,000 people through that. They did not hit the cap of 30,000, but still a fair amount of people. Is that reaching the people who need it, or are there a bunch of people who still can't come here because they can't find the sponsor or access the app to sign up for an appointment? You know, that's debatable. But he's trying to bring in some flow that way. But when you come in through humanitarian parole, that's temporary. That's up to 2 years that you're being suspended. Immigration is being suspended for you. It doesn't mean you get to permanently resettle. It doesn't mean you have a green card. You can try to get those things once you get here, but you're in kind of a state of limbo in the interim. Welcome Corps, which I talked about before, is part of the refugee admissions program. And that's designed to permanently resettle people. So these are people who get fully vetted. These are people who are generally identified by the UN's refugee agency. There's some vetting through that. Then the US does its own vetting. That process can be 1.5 to 2 years. But they're saying you're not a terrorist. We have an agency here who's going to help you resettle. Typically, that's been things like Catholic Charities, or there's a Jewish group, HIAS, there's a Lutheran group. These tend to be faith-based organizations. They send the refugees to a place where those organizations have a presence, and they help the refugees get settled. Welcome Corps is designed to go beyond that. So even if you're not near a Catholic Charities, you're just five people in a remote area who says, we've scraped up some money and we have a plan to find this person work or the family work. And they're going to be part of a community of people who are interested in getting them acclimated. You can be a sponsor too. But as it stands, that is to help people who are in the pipeline to be permanently resettled. So the question I try to pose in the article is, can this be expanded to handle, you know, the border influx? Because the refugee agencies, that's large people coming from like war-torn areas, places with civil strife, Congo, Syria, Myanmar. It hasn't done so much with Latin America. There's some, but not as much. If we can build the ranks of people saying, yes, I am happy to help a person in need, that is easier to bring a person in than dump a bunch of people at the door of the El Paso City Hall and say, figure it out. So it's just one other tool that Biden is trying to use to make things more orderly. And that potentially is more politically tolerable for people because their people are coming to places where other people want them to be there. It's not something being imposed on you suddenly. But it's still a numbers challenge to be able to accommodate everybody who is clamoring to get in because you have pandemic ravaged economies in places like Cuba or places like Haiti where the government is totally collapsed and gangs are running the country. And gang violence is rampant in a lot of these places. That is creating this huge influx that is challenging to accommodate. So anyway, I try to get into all that in the piece. That's and I know, Matt, you've been you're a pro-immigrant conservative. So I'm curious if you think Biden is doing the right thing here or if you think that he is being overly accommodating and that the pressure on the border is just too much.
Well, I would say, first of all, irrespective of Biden, just me, I am pro-immigration, probably less than I used to be, though. And the reason is that even though I personally believe that more immigrants, you know, obviously we have to vet, but more legal immigrants, more people, more ideas, all of those things are healthy and we need more people. But clearly we have seen, you know, I wrote a column, by the way, I mean, this is a weird comparison. It's a very imperfect analogy, but I wrote a column last week on, you know, the 20th anniversary of the Iraq invasion saying, you know, the invasion of Iraq was a bad idea and a mistake. And number one reason I can prove that is Donald Trump. It led to Donald Trump. And it's a pretty much a straight line between Iraq to Donald Trump's election. You don't have to take too many liberties to get to that. And I similarly think that that the perception that immigrants and immigration are problematic or bad for America help fuel the rise of Donald Trump. And so the fact that there are a lot of Americans, whether, you know, meritless or not, who feel that their country is changing or that they have lost their job and they assign a certain amount of blame to immigration and to the border, that is a problem. Whether it's real or not, the perception of it is a problem. And the proof I have is it gave us Donald Trump. That's proof it's a problem. And I don't want that anymore. So I'm probably a little more, a little less bullish about, you know, being as open. And I was never open borders. We, you know, that's a canard, but you get my point. I'm a little more cautious about that, or more conservative maybe in a sense than I used to be. Having said that, you know, I can't really speak to this new welcome corps idea specifically, but in general, you know, Biden has been criticized by the right, you know, and there is a problem at the border, obviously. But it seems like his policies, and I think initially Biden made a big mistake when he was running and when he first got elected, of kind of, I think his rhetoric inspired people to try to cross the border illegally. But since then, his actual policies, including maintaining some of Donald Trump's border policies, I think have been fairly good, surprisingly good. And I was listening to a podcast recently, Jonah Goldberg's excellent podcast, The Remnant, and he had someone on talking about nuclear energy and how, like, Joe Biden's actually been surprisingly good on nuclear energy. Apparently Gretchen Whitmer has too, for some reason that is beyond above my pay scale. So long wind up to say, it seems like Biden has not been some radical, crazy leftist open borders guy. And in fact, he's probably taken some heat from the progressives based on his policies.
Well, he is taking heat, and there may be lawsuits. There's lawsuits on both ends. You know, so there's already a law. So the humanitarian parole tack, which is we want to bring, you know, 30,000 people a month from these four countries on a temporary basis. There are 20 Republican attorneys general who have already sued to say, you know, this is an abuse of executive authority. You can't just, the humanitarian parole program is supposed to be applied on a case by case basis. It's not meant to be given for thousands of people to be approved at a fell swoop from a particular country. So that could get adjudicated unfavorably to Biden at some point. We don't know how long that's going to take for that case to go through the process. So it's possible that plan of Biden's gets scotched. And if once Biden's asylum plan gets formally implemented, which I assume will happen, he might get sued. The ACLU has already threatened that they will sue right away. And it could be that is in violation of what asylum law says. So, you know, Biden, this is true for things like, you know, this oil project that he approved up in Alaska, this Willow Project. You know, Biden is being challenged politically and being challenged legally. You know, so there's twin. You know, he might, there's a legal claim that the oil company had to drill there. That was definitely part of the calculation that the Biden team had to weigh. So you might get my sense is that the Biden people are largely pursuing on a path of what makes. I shouldn't say that because I think it is a general confluence of political and legal calculations they have to go through. So I don't know if really one is really more important than the other. But in terms of immigration is concerned, you have Democratic mayors, particularly Eric Adams in New York City, saying we can't handle this. We are not in a position to take in this many people all at once without any help from you, federal government, Biden administration. We've talked about this in some past shows. That issue is not completely exploded politically, as other things have gone on in the past several months that's kind of kept this to kind of a second tier issue, but it's always kind of rumbling. And Biden's trying to prevent it from becoming something that, you know, consumes the administration. And so he's trying to get ahead of it. And apparently he's made the decision that I might get some agita from my left here, but I got to accept that. Otherwise, I'm going to be completely overwhelmed. And of course, we don't even know exactly what's going to happen once Title 42 does end. So it's still unknown how complicated this issue is going to get. So this is an attempt to try to get ahead of it. And, you know, some complaints in the peanut gallery, probably Biden will take that over actually having hundreds of thousands of people pouring into the country and with no obvious place for them to be settled right away.
By the way, Bill, branding is interesting. You know, Tucker Carlson hasn't worn a bow tie in 15 years, but I've talked to people who swear he wore one last night on Fox News. You know what I mean? And similarly,
he's got a bow tie face.
And similarly, I haven't really written or said anything really pro immigration in probably a decade. I've written things like I thought when Trump first got elected, I thought he should do the Dream Act. But, you know, that applies to people who are already here, who, you know, came here through no fault of their own, who, you know, served in the military, whatever. It's not exactly pro-immigration. I wrote a piece for The Beast where I sort of defended Trump. And I said, like, you know, I'm for immigration by and large, but like, what percent? Like is what's the number? Like, at what point? Like assimilation's vital. Like at what point, like there has to be a point, there's too many immigrants this year that we can actually assimilate them. But it's been a long time since I've written something that was really full-throated pro-immigration. I mean, I was against kids in cages, but that's also different. But I'm telling you, like every once in a while, I'll talk to someone and it'll become clear to me that they think I am like radically open borders and that is the driving issue that animates my political existence. And again, I don't think I've really written or talked about that much in the past decade.
Well, I think you should. I mean, I know you're always looking for column ideas. I know you got book we're left to focus on right now, but I do think there's a lot going on with the Biden administration, immigration, and that will probably be more so once Title 42 does end. I mean, again, I don't know exactly where you'd come out on all of it, but I think you'd find the subject interesting because there's a lot of complicated cross pressures going on, innovative ideas being experimented with.
Big problem, Bill, but not as big a problem as what our politicians are doing, the way that these fat cats, they make $174,000 a year salary. Fine. How are they becoming millionaires on that salary? And it's a real problem, Bill. And I think you need to really focus on that. But anyway, we're at the 40-minute mark. I think we have time for another quick topic. And we did an extensive extensive pre-game plan, but which of the many topics, Bill, do you want to end on?
We know something. We talk about DeSantis a lot, and he is sort of a continually fascinating subject, and he's having a rough go of it, I think, in the past few days. It's interesting that the shine on DeSantis is fading somewhat, where people are starting to question whether he really can go toe-to-toe with Trump. Polling suggests that he's not succeeded in really making this, knotted up with him, although he's still the number two, but how does he get number one? And so here comes Chris Christie, of all people.
This is like the WWE, like Vince McMahon. Wait a second. I'm hearing Chris Christie's walk-on music. It's Chris Christie. He's got a chair.
Chris Christie peaked literally 12 years ago.
I'd say 11, but yeah.
Was it a 2011 when he gave the speech at the Reagan Library? Maybe it was 2012. I thought it was.
He should have run in 2012.
Yeah.
I think that we can now fairly conclusively say that he missed his window in 2012.
Yeah. There's no clamor for Chris Christie. There's no draft Christie clubs out there. He polls, I think, when he's included, I think around 1% or so. He does a town hall in New Hampshire, gets some sort of crowd, and basically says, if you're going to run against Trump, you got to take the fight to Trump, which is correct in my view. I mean, this is what really DeSantis hasn't been doing. And then I saw at the Bulwark,
Jonathan V. Last,
right?
I think wrote a really good piece. And the point he made is like, Chris Christie's hanging his hat on a moment he had, which was really kind of a murder suicide, where Christie took down Marco Rubio, and ended up coming, Christie still didn't propel himself, still dropped out of the race, still was kind of in last place or whatever. And are you going to hang your hat on being Christie saying, I'm paraphrasing JVL here, but Christie's saying like, I'm the man who's tough enough to take down Trump, and I can prove it because I had that one moment 8 years ago where I took down a different person who wasn't Donald Trump.
Well, here's my response to Last. So what? Look, Chris Christie, in many ways, is a phony. He was on the Trump train when he shouldn't have been. He's defended things of Trump's that are indefensible, in my opinion. And you could say that he's being a total political opportunist to try to get off the train now because he can't shake the presidential bug and he recognizes that Trump's in his way. And I have no great love of his tenure as governor in New Jersey. I think even though he got away with Bridgegate, I think Bridgegate was bad. I think he scotched an important infrastructure project that would have helped his own constituents for political reasons. So I got lots of problems with Chris Christie. But as far as it is important to stop Trump, which I think you at least share as a goal, like he is bad for America and bad for Republicans long haul. And no one else seems to have the basic guts to take the fight to Trump. Who cares if Chris Christie is a phony? If he's willing to do it, maybe he can't be the nominee. Maybe no one really wants him to be the nominee. It's ridiculous for him to be deluded if they think he can be. I'm not predicting he's going to be the nominee, but let's be thankful that someone is even entertaining the premise that if you got to take down Trump, you got to take down Trump. And it's not just that Chris Christie had one good moment with Marco Rubio. Like, the one of the reasons I really dislike Chris Christie is that I think he's really good at what he does. I think he's really smart. I think he's sharp. I think he's good unscripted. He actually has facts and figures, maybe of dubious quality at times, but like he can pull stuff out in the moment that makes him sound like he knows what he's talking about. And so that makes him hard to grapple with. Let's have somebody of some skill unleashed, someone who isn't worrying about how do I put piece together the coalition of Trumpers and soft Trumpers and ever Trumpers to win a primary with 40%. They just have a guy who's willing just to go at it. And if it's a murder suicide again, fine. Let Christie and Trump take each other out so someone else can get a crack at this thing. Be thankful someone is willing to take this guy on.
All right. You make a compelling case, and I'll concede most of what you said. I mean, I think Christie is a bully. I think he's smart. I think he's quick on his feet. DeSantis is not quick on his feet the way that Christie is. And Christie may be the only person who could kind of do that to Trump. I don't know if it works, though, because I think Christie, by sucking up to Trump, has kind of abdicated any credibility he might have. I think that it's very convenient that Christie now wants to run against Trump when he delivered us Trump. But here's my main rebuttal in favor of JVL's argument is this. Isn't it more, based on past experience, Bill, isn't it more likely that Chris Christie will use all of his talents, all of his skills to destroy Ron DeSantis and allow Donald Trump to become the Republican nominee? I mean, isn't that actually the pattern based on past performance?
Well, I mean, that's what happened with Rubio, obviously.
Yes. So why on earth would we want that again? That's what he does. He uses his intelligence and his quick wit and his toughness because he believes that he wants to get... The temptation is this. I need to get Donald Trump one-on-one. Therefore, I must knife Marco Rubio. Therefore, I must take down Ron DeSantis.
I mean,
that's the problem.
I mean, that is a problem in the race writ large.
I'm not going to cheer it. I'm not going to cheer this guy who delivered us Donald Trump last time, who destroyed Rubio. I'm not going to cheer on him getting in this race now as our savior.
Well, you don't have
the guys that he's now, having given us Trump and endorsed him, that he is now going to be our savior from Trump. That seems a bit much.
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to be skeptical. I'm not saying you got to open up your checkbook and like shower him with money, but I mean, at this stage of the game, like there's literally nobody else who was auditioning for the role of person who will actually criticize Trump in this presidential race. If so, it would be obviously ideal if someone who was totally uninvolved in the 2016 race and totally uninvolved in the Trump administration to play that role. But do you think is Glenn Youngkin? I mean, Glenn Youngkin has a certain amount of promise. There was a column in Politico urging him to run. I certainly get the logic behind that column that he kind of navigates the culture war well with this kind of happy, sunny, suburban fleece, persona. But does anyone think Glenn Youngkin is going to be the bulldog against Donald Trump? No. Is Christie Noem? No. So I really can't, maybe John Bolton, although he was in the Trump administration, so he's got to answer for some of that. But I just don't think you have anyone else who is competing to play that role. And if he's going to give it a shot, I mean, you can be encouraging to say, I would like Chris Christie insofar as he's willing to take on Donald Trump. If you spend all your energy around DeSantis, then, I retract any encouraging words that I have.
Well, the real question, Bill, is what do you, the people out there, think? Sound off in the comments. Let us know. Are you with me and JVL? Or are you with Bill Scherer and Chris Christie?
Now, I don't think Chris in the book. I do recall some stories about how Chris Christie was enjoying the high life as governor. So perhaps he deserved to be in the book.
He's got the beaches auto himself, sitting out there on his lawn chair.
And there's some Junkin type things that he did too. So,
is Chris Christie in the Filthy Rich Politicians? I don't even think he's mentioned.
I mean, you wrote it, not me, but I know,
but it's like 70,000 words. I don't think he's in there at all.
I don't think you mentioned him. I think, but you probably could have had him mentioned
if you ever
do a second printing with an epilogue, you probably could throw him in.
Well, only if Christie's more relevant. I think the reason he's not in the book is I don't think he rose to the. rose to the standard of being relevant. As you said, Bill, it's been a decade.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean, he's got nothing to lose. I mean, that's the thing. He's truly nothing to lose. If you are starting at 0%, you should approach this like you have nothing to lose and take the big swings. And again, you know, Tim Scott, another guy might get in, you know, he's not going to go punch Trump in the face.
Yeah.
You know, Christie enjoys a good punch in the face, and you at least have that confidence. The guy is a brawler, and I think a smart brawler. So let's hope. Let's have some hope that someone makes this a real fight.
All right, indeed. Bill Scherer, what do you got to plug?
Well, I mean, I went on about the immigration piece already, so check that out, the Washington Monthly.
All right. I had two really good podcasts this week. David Frum was on. And Kimberly Leonard of Insider she's down in Miami, talked about all things DeSantis, some really good insight about Casey DeSantis, Ron DeSantis's wife. So check that out. David Frum's always great. Don't miss that. And pre-order Filthy Rich Politicians by all means. I'll keep you posted, Bill, about the car. Hopefully, okay. things will be okay by the time we get back here next week in the DMC.
Best of luck to you, and we'll talk again next week.
All right, see you guys.